Part of the reason we're down here in South Florida today is the Miami Book Fair, which brings authors from around the world to town. And we're talking to all sorts of authors for a series of interviews that you'll hear later this month on The Takeaway. But I got a chance to reconnect with my good friend and fellow amateur cook, Adam Gopnik, yesterday, right here at WLRN. His mind, of course, is a melange of ideas about food and culture and history. His latest book is a wise and warm companion for anyone interested in food. The Table Comes First, France, Family, and the Meaning of Food. New Yorker writer Gopnik says the act of cooking is the perfect mixture of big world-scale ideas and small tasks in the kitchen. And he says with relief that when you're cooking, you can't multitask. You can't without over-salting the soup or ruining the souffle.
You can't watch television and cook at the same time. There are things you can do. Listen to music, obviously, is one. Listen to the radio is another. Listen to your own thoughts is one more. One of the things I talk about in the book is it's become a real convention now in contemporary literature to have somebody cooking when they have to think their way through a difficult problem. In 19th century literature, you usually sent them on a walk. George Eliot or Trollope would send those people on a good long country walk. And in sort of mid-century fiction, John Updike or Ann Tyler, they would always be sent in a long car drive. But in our time, when somebody has to do a lot of hard thinking, we have them hard at work making a casserole.
And they're hard at work doing things that we long to be a part of, but are not necessarily part of the story. You have literary categories for why and where food comes up. I wonder if you'd explain those.
Let me see if I can recall them all. There's one thing that happens often is you have food in literature that's there just to be a sign of who someone is. If a Trollope clergyman eats his steak and porter, you know, that's because he's a clergyman. Then you have food, like the food in the James Bond books. People forget how much great food there is in Ian Fleming's James Bond books, which is there for the author to eat instead of the character.
Right.
So that, you know, Bond is constantly getting, we get long menus of his eating caviar and then squab and pigeons, things that don't sound like what a paid assassin would typically eat. But you know that Ian Fleming was someone who loved his caviar on just the right amount of toast. There's a wonderful line in one of the Bond books, Moonraker, I think, where he says, the problem isn't getting enough caviar, it's getting enough toast to go with it. When I read that when I was 11, I said, that's the way to live, right?
But you tell us, as a good reporter in this book, that in fact that's preposterous. The problem with caviar is not the toast at all.
No, the problem with caviar is not the toast. The problem with caviar is the caviar. It is wandering from the world. That's when you're 12, you think, aha, someday I will tell somebody it's the toast, not the caviar. When you're past 40, you know it's the caviar, not the toast.
You tell the great story in as comprehensive a way as I've seen, but you also lead me to people who've made a life study of where restaurants came from. But I'm even more struck by the story of where recipes came from, which is part of the story of this book.
Yeah, there's, you know, sort of the two pillars of modern eating are the restaurants, the place you go, and the recipe, which is what you cook from when we're at home, those of us who, like you and me, who live to do this thing. And what's fascinating about the recipe book is the first recipe books are really sort of abbreviated guide for pros. You know, you're in your kitchen, you're a caterer or a cook, and you say, how do you make that damn sauce bernaise? And you look at it quickly. And then they emerge as ways for middle-class women to learn how to behave in the kitchen. At a time in the mid-19th century, in England particularly, the restaurant's a French invention, but the recipe book is mostly an English invention because cooking in France was still done mostly by pros, which says, you've got this family, you've got to feed them, here's how you do it well. And so you get the recipe book in the 19th century, and then you begin to get one of my favorite variants, the narrative recipe book, which I associate with the British writer Elizabeth Pennell, who's an important character in the book. And then we end up in our own day with a kind of cookbook you and I have to deal with, which is, what shall we call it? It's essentially a guide to aspiration. It's things that you will never be able to make, prepared with methods that you will never be able to master, and yet nonetheless which you will continue to aspire to as long as you have a kitchen.
You know, the Thomas Keller cookbook, the French Laundry cookbook, which was one of the original food pornography kinds
Absolutely.
Of coffee table cookbooks. You spill some béarnaise sauce on it and oh,
you feel horrible.
You feel horrible. Yeah. What would Thomas say?
Exactly.
But he must want you to actually try these recipes, yet
when you enter into this book, it's all about this relationship with fish that you wish you had, and the fishmonger.
And his purveyors, exactly.
Oh, my God, his
purveyors. No, it's a very big thing about that book is his purveyors. He introduces you to his purveyors, which is great for Thomas, right? But not hugely helpful for somebody who's going to be running across the street. I do one thing from that cookbook, which is a very good cookbook. It has, do you remember, 15 pages on how to truss a chicken?
Yes.
And I've occasionally trusted chicken for the fun of it. But I do, he has a wonderful recipe for short ribs, which only has about 18 separate steps spread out over four
and special
separate
sauces.
Days. Exactly. And but you know what? At the end of the time of it all, it's worth it. So I do that one. But that's almost easy compared to some of the others. You know, you'll find the modernist cooks, you know, the guys from Barcelona who do molecular cooking now have cookbooks, and you need to have a sous vide machine, one of those specially made things in which you put all the meats in sealed tight plastic bags and you boil them essentially at set temperatures.
Can you win a Nobel Prize for chemistry these days?
I think so. I mean, the key thing that happened, right, it was the last or latest big revolution in food is when those guys, the Adria brothers around El Bulli in Barcelona, really did form an alliance with a chemist at the University of Barcelona and said, let's take all of these techniques, many of which were designed for industrial food, freeze-drying things, turning things into foams and into gels, things that were not for good food but for mass food, and said, let's try and apply them to our art. Let's try and make them artful. It's essentially a form of circus, John. You know, it's meant to be fun. You're there. You're not paying. You're paying for the food, but essentially it's a form of show. It takes us back almost to the kind of 18th century roots of fancy cooking, where it was as much about the giant pièce montée that showed the sack of Rome laid out in pastry as it was about the taste of it. The problem, I think, is that when a lot of that style has been translated into America, if you go to the fancy molecular place in most American cities, it's insanely churchy. You know, Americans, we're good at moralizing things. Give us anything and we'll moralize it. Military affairs or Spanish cooking. So we're not content just to say, sit back, this is going to be wacky and fun. We have to say, this will change your life. If you just follow the bouncing salts, right, the volcanic salt, the Himalayan salt, the pink deep sea salt, and so on. We take things awfully seriously.
Adam Gopnik, the writer of The Table Comes First, France, Family, and the Meaning of Food. More from Gopnik next week on our Thanksgiving show.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.